is the Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy, meeting March 2nd, 2007, at 12 p.m. in Lincoln City, chaired by Senator Berger. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Preparedness and Ocean Policy on March the 2nd, 2007 to order. Good afternoon. I am Joanne Berger. I am one of the co-chairs of the committee and will be chairing the meeting today. My district is District 5, Senate District, and so I hope that you know that I'm in my district and that many of you are my constituents, and I want to just say that we are extremely happy to be here today. I'm going to start at this end of the dais, and I'm going to have the committee members to introduce themselves and to tell you a little bit about themselves.
Okay. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, which is part of Lane County. Lynn County, I'm from the city of Springfield. I'm a flatlander, and I love to come to the coast. I did introduce a bill three sessions ago on the tsunami warning system. That was before anyone even thought of a tsunami. We're still working on the implementation of that bill. We still don't have all of the lodging places posting the required information. That's a problem. We're still working on sirens now. Obviously, sirens only work, I think, for Alaskan earthquakes. The siren will probably drop 5 feet as the land falls when we have the big one, so people will know when that happens. They're not going to need a siren. I think the coast is a wonderful place. I'm not sure what it's going to look like with full build-out. People, for some reason, want to move to the most dangerous parts of our country. Well, if there's a hurricane around, they want to move there. If there's a tornado, they move there. If there's going to be a tsunami, everyone wants to be where the action is. And so it's really frustrating. And so we have to think about zoning. And there will be a bill that will consider zoning options before and after a tsunami, so people will have some certainty when they start to rebuild. We're working on that aspect also. So, and I love the rain, so I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, I was looking at Jim, and I was waiting for him to speak.
No.
Hi, I'm Deborah Boone, and I hail from the upper left coast, just above you here in House District 32, which is all of Tillamook, most of Clatsop, some western Washington County, and a little bit of Columbia County. And I've lived on the coast since 1974, and we bought an old nursery, a native plant nursery, and 100 acres in trees. And everybody thought, why would you go to the beach and then buy a tree farm and live so far from the beach? We're 12 miles inland. And I said, well, someday we're probably going to have oceanfront property. So we quietly grow our trees, and I enjoy clam digging, and I know that that's when the tsunami comes, I want to be on the beach, and I don't care if I have my limit at that point, but I want to be clam digging because that's exactly what I love to do here.
Representative Cowan?
Representative Boone, I certainly hope your dream doesn't come true. It's good to be home. I'm Jean Cowan, and know most of you in the room. I represent District 10 here in Lincoln County, and it's great to be able to bring our Salem operation here for the local folks.
And I'm State Representative Donna Nelson from Yamhill and Polk County. This is my fourth term in the legislature. I hope y'all all come see our Spruce Goose Museum and that we can then compliment you and your special locations for tourism and help one another. We also, together, need to work on that Newburgh-Dundee bypass that is desperately needed because we can't get, you know, the tourists here fast enough, nor can we get rid of them quickly. And so I think we need to declare that an emergency, Madam Chair. Vote on it and pass it today. But I have had the distinct honor of being the chair of the House Committee of Veteran Affairs, kind of like a first time in 147 years, I guess, when I was there. And I just want to be mindful today of the other veterans in the audience. If you're a veteran, I'd love for you to stand up and we'd recognize you. Please. All right. Well, I thank you so much. We're so grateful for all you've done for us, to risk your life for ours. I'd like to invite all of you to come to Salem to the Department of Veteran Affairs and see the beautiful new, first in the nation, Afghan-Iraqi Freedom War Memorial. And it's done with volunteer money, volunteer help, and please come see it. It's really worth it.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Jim, tell us what you do.
I'm Jim Keller. I'm one of your committee administrators. The other committee administrator is Judith Towns in the back of the room.
Hi, Judith. Welcome. We're glad you're here. I see Sheriff Dodson. Are there other elected officials in the audience? Well, welcome, Sheriff. We're happy to see you today. All right. We're going to start off our agenda with House Bill 2185. Jim?
Thank you, ma'am. House Bill 2185 authorizes the Director of Human Services to appoint a public health director, defines the duty of the public health director, establishes authority of public health director, state public health authority, and local public health authority to take certain actions during a public health emergency, modifies the authority of the governor to take certain actions during a state of public health emergency.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 2185, and I'd like to call Dr. Susan Allen, and with her, Thomas Ashenbrenner. Welcome, Dr. Allen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Susan Allen. I'm the State Public Health Director. This is a very powerful microphone. Tell me if I'm too close or need to move it. I hope I can be heard clearly.
Maybe move back.
Needs to be further away.
Put it on the floor instead of that. I appreciate very much the opportunity to come talk about this bill, which we believe will help move the emergency preparedness for the state of Oregon considerably forward, especially with respect to our ability to address the health, public health, and medical aspects of emergencies. I will be presenting an overview of the bill, and then we will be inviting Thomas Ashenbrenner, who, in his capacity as chair of the Public Health Advisory Board, to address a bit of their relationship to and sponsorship of this.
Dr. Allen, while we're waiting just a moment, I failed to call on Representative Cowan, and I want to do that right now before you begin. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Dr. Allen and Thomas Ashenbrenner for being with us today and give just a little bit of a lead-in. As most of you in the audience know, I was a county commissioner here in Lincoln County for 12 years, and as I looked at the county management plans for emergency response, which is something that's very near and dear to my heart, very important to me, I realized just kind of how flimsy some of our authorities were when it, and that may not be the best word, but that's how I'd look at it, in terms of some of the challenges that we might potentially face to deal with the health pieces of almost any natural disaster or other emergency. Subsequently, I was also a member of the Public Health Advisory Board. Many of the members of that or that group are here with us today, too. And we have worked for years on looking at this question of the public health law and how we can better structure it to make all of us more effective if we face that catastrophic emergency at the state level, and then thereby moving that into our communities where we are going to need the backup and the help to deal with the things right here at home. So I just need to say that I am delighted to have this piece of legislation before us today. It's been a long time coming. There's been a lot of work, a lot of study that's gone into it, which these presenters are going to explain to us. But I just urge this committee to take this very seriously, and hopefully we'll be able to move this forward. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. And I want to say to Dr. Allen and to Thomas both that Representative Cowan has been great to have on this committee with her health background. And certainly we have Senator Marcet as well. So we have two on the committee that have a very rich background in how we're going to deal with the health problem. So I think that's very advantageous to those of you who are working professionally in the on this job. All right, Dr. Allen, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe the committee received an email from Ken Murphy, who is the director of the Office of Oregon Emergency Management. And I would like to start by noting his points that he supports this and that is long overdue, but in particular that in almost every disaster or emergency, there is a public health component, and that this legislation will help strengthen Oregon's ability and overall preparedness by helping us be better prepared to address the health and medical components. I think, in general, emergency preparedness had under-involved health and medical aspects of the disasters across the country and in this state. And in some ways, we're playing catch-up and recognizing that after the Office of the Oregon Emergency Management operations, the second most involved series of activities in most emergencies do turn out to be health, medical, and public health. The awareness of this has also greatly increased with the emergencies of the last 5 years. The anthrax events were primarily public health emergencies. SARS, West Nile virus, and even what we saw with the tragic incidences post-Katrina related to providing appropriate medical care and just basic humanitarian care for people in that hurricane-affected area. So this bill grows out of a heightened awareness of the importance of being able to address these, which then led to a study of Oregon's laws, which were found to be really quite lacking. Flimsy, I believe, is not an inappropriate word. There also are significant gaps, and there's confusion in the parts of the public health laws which do exist. We convened a group of concerned people arising from what I heard from the community. Doctors would say, in an emergency, I might have to do things differently, and I want to make sure that what I'm doing is consistent with what people down the street or next county over are doing. It looks very bad. It's bad care for people. It looks bad, and it also puts physicians at risk legally if they find that people are doing different things. Hospitals said the same thing. If we don't have enough supplies and we have to make hard decisions, we want to make sure that other hospitals are using the same framework to make those decisions. It's only fair to the patients, and it provides legal risk if hospitals are doing different things. Local health departments are experiencing more and more disease outbreaks. The local health departments also said most of the time things can be handled locally in the community. But when they get to a certain magnitude, the consistency, you want to know that your neighboring community, your neighboring county, is making the same, using the same framework for the decision making as you are in your own. Our current laws do not provide the tools to make those things happen. So we worked with those partners, the people that we were hearing from, the doctors, the hospitals, the local health departments, the counties, and also the ACLU, to analyze what were the critical gaps. And this bill is undoubtedly imperfect, but we think substantially progressive attempt to address the key areas that were recognized. I believe you have received an information sheet which provides a very brief summary of what is a very long bill with a lot of details in the bill. I will take you through what some of the key points are, the key topic areas that we identified, and what the proposals are and how those are a change from what we currently have. To begin with, it was important to establish the State Public Health Authority as being a player, having a role in addressing emergencies. That is not currently established in the state's law. With respect to that, particularly the bill attempts to address what would be the types of situations in which a state authority would become necessary to be active and potentially dominant, to take a stronger and lead role. So there are the characteristics of the kinds of events that might require a public health director to take action that would be different from a normal daily event. There is a trigger process in the bill where the public health director identifies the circumstances are consistent with those outlined in the bill, presents that to the governor's office for authorization by the governor's office to invoke those authorities. So it's not just on the public health director's say-so. It's the public health director makes the case, identifies the situation, and receives authorization from the governor's office to then invoke and apply those authorities in the bill. I'm told this is analogous to something that currently exists with the state fire marshal for some circumstances. These are for situations that are less than where a full declaration of emergency is needed. Even with the anthrax events, which involved a very large number of people, it remained a health and medical issue, not a widespread community infrastructure issue. And governors and mayors did not make declarations of emergency in that event. Similarly with SARS, with monkeypox and others. So typically with diseases, when the situation is constrained to being primarily health and medical, and the only measures you need to invoke are health and medical, that would not normally rise to a level of meriting or of obtaining a governor's declaration of emergency in states across the country. And that's a provision that we're finding to be more and more necessary, not just if we had an unexpected and more major event, but even with some of the larger outbreaks we're beginning to see more regularly now. If we had a massive measles exposure that affected five counties, the counties would benefit from, and the physicians and the schools would want some consistency in how that was being addressed. So this is a tool that we believe would be useful and occasionally used, even with things that are likely to happen, short of the more massive earthquake scenario that we were addressing earlier. There's also some confusion in current statutes about what is a local authority and what is a state authority. And this bill attempts to make it clearer that for most events, most days, local authority is dominant, and that's appropriately so. And to be very clear when a handoff or when a negotiated change needs to occur. Statutes that are now in existence around health and medical issues and public health matters use a variety of different phrases and definitions and terms that make it hard to figure out how they fit together from one place to another. So we've attempted to use more contemporary language. We looked for everything that we're talking about here. We looked at a national model public health act And also, quite a few states have done significant revisions of their own public health laws in the last 5 years. We looked at those and attempted to use the terms that appeared to be clearest, most consistently used, that would also allow us to be consistent with adjacent states and with the federal government, recognizing the possibility of interactions, and so that there would be a common framework of vocabulary, not guessing about when one term applies elsewhere. Quarantine and isolation statute that we now have neither protects individual rights nor communities effectively. It does not have modern and appropriate due process. For example, someone who has been isolated because they have a disease does not explicitly have the right to make a request, a legal request for a hearing to be released under our current law. That does not seem appropriate. We also have very confusing and rather limited authorities and provisions for being able to confine people or assess whether people present a hazard, an infectious hazard, in their communities. And also with respect to something like a larger group, if we had a high school where someone had had an atypical measles and we needed to do some short-term assessment of who might be at risk in order to address a whole group. Our current laws do not provide how to give them appropriate notice, determine effectively what is the minimum amount of confinement or restriction to provide, and then monitor that and manage that in a legally appropriate way. There are very considerable number of the pages in this bill address the various circumstances around quarantine and isolation. In my previous job in a different community, we had a patient with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis who said that he would feel better if he could get treatment while he was with his family, and he was going to get on an airplane and go fly with his family. There was no way at that time in that state to stop that, and I had a role in Virginia in getting an emergency quarantine isolation law put through so that we could prevent that in future cases. Oregon's in the same situation. We currently have no clear provision for emergency detention of someone, which you would use extremely rarely, but there's no substitute for it if you did need it, and those would be the kinds of cases if someone said, for example, that they were going to go do something that would expose children to a disease or, you know, someone, others who are vulnerable. This gives a provision for 72 hours of detention in very restricted circumstances and full civil rights to that individual. There are a number of things that public health needs to be able to bring to assessing a risk and to controlling a risk besides just quarantine and isolation. And the bill attempts to outline so that people would understand what the tools are that are available to a local public health director or at the state level for assessing a risk, for supporting other kinds of treatment and taking other guidelines. Also, with respect to the circumstances I mentioned earlier, where hospitals would want to know that there was some consistency in what was being done in an event where we had limited antibiotics or limited ventilators, and you needed to make hard decisions about how you use those resources, or the laboratory was already backed up and we had to start restricting what kinds of tests were done on which kinds of patients. The provisions, the authority for making those decisions is now clearly specified in this bill. And this is worth a little extra comment here. This could come up, for example, with a vaccine shortage. Our current laws, through a bill that was passed just a few sessions ago, we do have, during a flu vaccine season, for example, the authority to direct who are the priority populations for using the vaccine. We do not, let's say we had a flu that was highly lethal, which is we've fortunately not had recently, so that we needed to take a stronger hand in how the vaccine was actually used and make sure it got to the people that needed it most. We do not currently have the authority to move the vaccine around to make sure that it's redirected to where it's most needed and most valuable. But we're the same with others. Now, those rights are laid out here. Those authorities are laid out here. That also creates some protections for physicians, hospitals, other healthcare providers, in that if there is a shortage or if there's a lack of laboratory access or other things that require that the provider has to do medical care differently from a normal day, that raises a concern of liability, understandably. What will people think that I'm doing it differently? But if we have the authority to set a state guideline that then clearly redefines what the standard of care would be, you not only would have both the political and the social and the fairness benefits of everyone getting the same kind of treatment, you also have reestablished the standard of care against which liability would be measured. And while that doesn't cover all imaginable liabilities, that would be a major advance in liability protection above what we have in the current law, where you could end up with a patchwork of practices and no real authority for them to have changed how they normally do business. In looking at the overall state emergency preparedness laws, I stumbled into the fact that we do not currently have any authorization for anyone to take control of human remains if we had a large number of remains, which overwhelmed the normal systems for managing that. As we worked with the medical examiner's office and the various associations and boards of funeral directors and morticians on the provision that is in here, most of the management would not be done by public health, but the authority to say that there is a need to take control of this situation and do it in a way that is respectful, that preserves the identity of the individuals. That's an essential part of a state's emergency response system, and that's a gap that we thought needed to be addressed here.
Dr. Allen, where there is thousands of deaths, how would they go about identifying people, and how would people in this audience, if they were faced with an emergency, what do they do so that in case they lose their life, that people can identify them?
Madam Chair, the second question is one I'd like to get back to you on what's the best recommended way to ensure that you could be identified. I hadn't actually thought of that, and I haven't seen recommendations. On the first part of the question, we have been involved with public health and with other aspects of the emergency system in developing mass casualty plans, which ensure that all remains are properly stored and that identifying data are collected in the best possible way in the short term, with a clear plan that they would be treated as respectfully as possible and that the ultimate goal is to have the identified information then available for the family or other loved ones to later on claim and in their family's preference way deal with the remains. So there are actually some good systems out there. Other states have had the misfortune of actually practicing them on occasion. This is something for which there's some pretty good information. The important thing is to have it planned and that the critical partners, which do include the medical examiners and the funeral directors and nursing homes, they are aware of the plan and prepared to do that. And we've made significant advances in that. And also that the understanding of what is an appropriate short-term storage and then a long-term plan is addressed.
And it's a good time maybe to mention it. I was approached by someone just yesterday about the fact that maybe the state may need to look into some sort of reciprocity legislation to be able to immediately access morticians and you know, people in that trade to come into Oregon and help out if necessary.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, there are actually already several agreements. They may not cover every specific component of what you just said, but Oregon is signatory to the EMAC, and you work with an acronym, you start to forget what it stands for, Emergency Management Assistance Compact, I believe, that all of the lower 48 states are signatory to, which includes some provisions such as that. In addition, we have signed a voluntary memorandum of understanding between the Secretary of Health in Washington State and I, on behalf of Oregon with respect to the health and medical components to ensure, now it's in memorandum of understanding, it doesn't carry the full weight of law, but that we believe also sets the framework for accelerating some of those provisions. The issue you raise applies, of course, not just to funeral directors, but to physicians or fire or any other group of people that could be essential depending on the kind of emergency. And that issue, along with the general liability issues, are ones that I hope at some point the state will have an opportunity to address as a package. I'm a little wary of pulling out just medical responder liability issues when there's so many other responders who have similar issues, or mutual aid arrangements should apply across the whole range of responders, not just for medical, although some of the specific details need to be worked out, of course, for each discipline.
I want you to continue, but we do have mutual aid agreements. However, they do not refer to health. They refer to transportation and where the counties can ask for assistance of each other. But without this bill, the mutual aid agreements that we passed on the floor of the Senate this week refers to other issues and not to health.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that point. I was actually thinking in terms of mutual aid with other states, but that is what you just identified, an important gap.
Right,
within
because
the state
we did pass a bill out, but I don't want people to think that that includes what you're talking about. All right, continue on.
And I'm close to wrapping up. The last major area that I wanted to address, there, besides the health emergencies you think of, such as in Katrina, where people need medical care, we also at State Public Health have the responsibility for managing toxic exposures that threaten health or radiation exposures that threaten health. And that is also a really essential part of the emergency preparedness role that State Public Health has played. We're hindered in some of the actions by gaps in our current law. There's a certain almost catch-22 at the moment where in order to go on a property to assess and mitigate a toxic or radiation hazard right now, we have to be able to prove the hazards there without going on the property. You know, you can see where that can sometimes be limiting. There also are certain provisions right now where identified hazards occur, but they fall in sort of a no-man's land among the different state agencies where there are a few hazards that have arisen since I've been here in the state that no agency had jurisdiction over. So we've attempted in this bill to present both that for appropriate due cause, due concern, that there would be the authority to go on property to assess a hazard and then to take the appropriate actions to ensure that that hazard is addressed in a way that protects the health of people. It specifically will note we have quite a few amendments that we're working on ourselves. I understand that that the committee is well aware that some of these bills came out in perhaps a not totally refereed process because of the haste and the also this is a very large bill. So we will be ourselves introducing a significant number of housekeeping and sort of tidying up amendments.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Marcet.
Thank you. We have another bill that we're going to hear today, and it's one that we've talked about in the past, you and I. And whether or not you have any authority to take a look at ship breaking activities, and you told me at the time that you do not have any authority. Now, if this bill passes, you should be able to go on board before the ship even gets here to find out if there's any health hazards, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I have to think about whether I would want that as well. I certainly want to protect health. Let me be perfectly clear. I want to do whatever is necessary to protect health. I believe that as currently worded, this would address a current rather than a potential hazard. So, I mean, I'm trying to be cautious and also fair to what is written in this law. And I think this addresses a present hazard, which is creating a current health risk, rather than an assessment of whether something might create a risk if it were to happen.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yeah, briefly. Okay, let's say that the ship arrives. We dry dock. We don't know what's on the ship. somebody may have done some kind of an assessment where the ship came from. Would you have the authority to go on the ship before other people do, before workers do, and take a look under this bill at health hazards on that property before people are exposed to things that may or may not be on the document? I mean, we don't know what's on that property when they bring it here. It's here. It's on a dry dock.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, this will merit much more discussion because it's fairly complex, and I'm trying to be the State Public Health Director, not the Attorney General. But I think the incident you just raised also actually would go into an OSHA question because the people would be going on the ship for the purposes of working on it. But if, I mean, something analogous where people were on a ship and then they were getting sick, there would be some circumstances, not, I think, precisely the one you mentioned, where we might have some. I would also be remiss if I didn't point out, on behalf of Gail Shibley, our Office of Environmental Public Health Director, that we at this point have no toxicology staff with which to do these things, but we would have the authority if we had the staff to do it and if present hazard existed.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Just want to, and I'm also not the Attorney General either, but I think that when a ship comes in, especially if it's from a foreign country, the first people to board are the ship's agents and immigration people, the U.S. federal employees, and if there's some sort of hazard on board, they can have it declared and take it from there before any kind of, workers get on the, and it takes several hours to get those ships cleared in most cases.
Thank you.
Right. Continue on.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I just have a few summary points that I would like to make. I did mention the issue of liability, and that is important because in the strong partnership we had in developing this bill, there were some points on which full concurrence could not be reached. I do believe that the intense involvement that we had with the Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, ACLU, Association of Oregon Counties, and Conference of Local Health Officials resulted in substantial agreement on the primary points in the bill. The clear need, no one disagreed with the need for making these types of changes. Some of the details we're still discussing. We are increasing our list of proposed amendments every day, but most of them are clarification and tidying ones. So I did want to note that while there will still be some points that we could not fully address, we have had, I think, very constructive and significant frequency of conversation, and their assistance with this and their willingness to have this serious discussion has been invaluable in teaching us about the conditions in the state and how to help them do their jobs in emergencies much better as well. And I believe that is my
for the benefit of our audience today, the bill is 2185. It's 25 pages. And with the groups you've heard her talk about that are trying to get together and agree on all of these fine points of the 25-page bill, they are now working on amendments to clarify some of the issues in the bill. That's one of the slow processes of government in order to get it exactly the way that we hope that it will not have unintended consequences. That doesn't mean that we get it perfect every time, but there is always this tremendous effort to get it done. Dr. Allen, before we move over to your guest, I want to ask you how you would describe your integration of your department with law enforcement, who are also on the scene, perhaps where chlorine, for instance, is used.
Madam Chair, that's an excellent example, and we have developed a chemical emergency response plan, actually, that we've had for about a year in State Public Health, and our integration with Oregon Emergency Management is quite good. They've been very involved. Taking it down to the community level is something that is incomplete. The mutual roles, I think, are not fully understood. I would say, if you would allow me, in general, that the relationship between public health and medical responders in an emergency and law enforcement and fire merits considerable attention and development in this state, and that's something that I'm very committed to, especially with our responsibilities for EMS. The way it should work, and this comes from my previous experience dealing with exactly what you just said, or an overturned truck at 3:30 in the morning on a freeway that started burning and was billowing fumes of nobody knew what in a neighborhood that was highly residential with lots of young children. And I got a 3:30 a.m. call from our fire chief, in fact, wondering what should be done in my last job. The roles include helping protect the police and fire and helping protect the community. So our roles become that of kind of translators into health terms of the technical and engineering issues that were present in the situation. So we dealt with a toxicologist, talked to a pediatrician, worked closely with the press so that people in the community knew, but also from the perspective of protecting first responders. I know that fire may have access to more technical information. Police rarely do. And one of our first responsibilities is to help them have the information about their own risks and hazards as the very first thing that we do, even at the same time that we're setting up the assessment for the community. I'm not sure if I've answered your question or not.
Yes, I think you have. I always worry about in times of chaos, which people are so upset and trying to save their lives or find their family or what have you, and in terms of particularly of some type of chemical spill or dangerous activity like that, the health piece of this is extremely important, but you also have to coordinate with the military if they're involved or the local law enforcement. And so it should be seamless. In other words, we don't want it where you're interfering or what they're interfering with you. So I think that was the point of my question.
Madam Chair, then let me assure you that we are working. Every plan we have works under the incident command system. All of our lead staff in state and local public health have been trained in the national incident management system. We do joint exercises with state and local emergency managers because the point you made is absolutely essential. In an emergency, people need to know who is responsible for which pieces and how to put the pieces together. And working with NIMS, as it's called, National Incident Management System, I went from being totally ignorant in my last experience in the National Capital Region to being a true believer that it is a good, crisp management structure. And we have made significant progress in ensuring not only our own training, but joint training. We've sponsored a number of trainings with police, fire, FBI, and sheriffs in multiple places around the state based on a Centers for Disease Control training program called Forensic Epidemiology. And it's an excellent program, and it addresses exactly the questions that you were raising. We need to do more of that, but we have the right tools, and at least we've moved in that direction considerably.
I'm going to ask you one more scenario, and then I'll ask the committee if they will have any questions of you before we move on. In Katrina, the doctors that were there made presentations to us and testified that when they arrived at the airport, there were 10,000 people injured. These people had not eaten for 48 hours. The trucks arrived, the food trucks, but they had no police. So they went to the health providers and wanted to know if they were ready to feed the flock. And they said they could not open the doors of the food trucks until they had some kind of military or law enforcement people there to do it. This is the kind of thing, and maybe you'd like to comment on that scenario, but that's the kind of thing that's so integrated with the job that you do.
Madam Chair, that's a very difficult situation, and I don't know anyone who doesn't think that Katrina in some ways was a case where almost anything that could go wrong did. And even just starting from baseline, while I'm a strong advocate for Oregon needing to take emergency preparedness much more seriously, as you're well aware, I think our existing systems have a history of coordinating with each other that would at least, we would have a better starting point. The larger system is not totally within my responsibility, as you know, but I do think that the opportunity to have on-the-ground decisions to do what's practical when needed, which is one issue, and then also to be able to communicate the information to bring in the resources is something that is a good, strong conversation here. I wish I could guarantee that I knew for sure that that wouldn't occur, and I cannot see that.
Questions? Senator Marchette.
Thank you. Seeing how the governor requested this bill, obviously it's in his budget. Is there a fiscal impact on this? It's hard to tell.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, there's not a direct impact, but there's an indirect impact. As part of reviewing the process for this bill, we identified that even on an average day, most of our local health departments and many of our state public health programs are not currently equipped to fully protect people. So in relationship to that, in order to enhance the ability of public health to assure that people are protected every day as well as in an emergency, we do have a budget proposal in a policy option package for about $5 million, which would allow us to significantly increase the extremely modest state funding to local public health and to add a few state positions whose roles should be specifically supportive community health and emergency development.
Good luck.
Dr. Allen, it's just been brought to my attention. This is not going to be a referral, however, to Ways and Means. So you have a policy option package within your budget.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I appreciated the opportunity to speak on behalf of resources to protect people, but it is not directly associated with this bill.
That's fine. That's fine. I'd do the same thing if I were you. All right. Other questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question. Do we have scheduled to hear from the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems on today's agenda?
I don't see them on the list.
In that case, Dr. Allen, did you get a copy of the memo that we have in our packet from the OAHHS requesting some amendments?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, the letter itself I got just when I arrived at the hearing, a quick glance suggested that it's part of the ongoing conversation we've been having. There are particular issues relate to liability, compensation for takings, and also some questions around specific words that are used with respect to ability to direct health systems or health programs to do things.
Thank you.
A number of those, I think, will be able to find common ground. The specific liability provisions, I think, will remain a concern of theirs.
Follow up. I just raised the issue so that we could put that together with your discussions of amendments. I wanted to make sure that they weren't missed in that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair and Dr. Allen, thank you for all you do and for being here today. My first question relates to immigration. And I'm just curious, we were told in, I remember, another committee that there's a huge influx of immigrants with tuberculosis. And I'm just curious at what have we found here, and do we have to have something at our borders? I mean, this could be people from California.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure we screen people for whether they've arrived from California or not, but we do screen for country of origin or country of birth and also for recent travel. Oregon's tuberculosis rates are extraordinarily low, actually. We're way below the national average. The county that I previously had been responsible for on the East Coast by itself had almost as many cases in an average year as the whole state here. It is true that the tuberculosis is more common in certain other parts of the world, and therefore people who come particularly from Southeast Asia or from some of the refugee camps in Africa have arrived in the United States more likely to have been exposed with tuberculosis. But while individual cases may more often be foreign-born or recent travel, that's the other risk, our overall rates are still quite modest.
Follow. Oh, well, that's good news. Do we have an epidemic of herpes in our state at this current time?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, herpes is not a reportable disease, and we are not hearing through our channels that we are. We do know that we have significant increases in chlamydia, for example, and a number of other diseases that are sexually spread are somewhat increasing. Again, our rates on the whole are actually pretty modest as well. I could, if you had, you'd be welcome to follow up with me afterwards, or I'll follow up with you and see if there's additional information we could provide you about herpes.
Another quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. This is very important to me because it seems everywhere I went in my previous life, to many states like Ethiopia with the Good Ship Friendship to take them wheat, we learned you had to take a person from World Vision with you if that wheat was ever going to get to people who needed it, or in any of the other countries of Africa where we've done many things. I guess what I'm concerned about is that how many people does it take to call it an emergency? I went through this entire book, and I don't see where that is defined. It's kind of like science being defined. So I'm wondering what constitutes a call from you.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, we did try to give it some specificity because it was important for everyone to understand. We didn't define it down to numbers because it depends on the disease. So I could give you some examples. 15 cases of measles might be a multi-county emergency that would include some state intervention. One or two cases of measles is not. One case of smallpox or one case of deliberately created anthrax would be an emergency. In an average year, 1,000 cases of influenza is not an emergency. So some of it has to do with what the background ability of the communities to deal with it would be, whether it rises. We say specifically, for example, at multiple communities, exceeds the normal capacity of a local community to deal with it appropriately or quickly, that it's something for which there's a pressing need for uniformity, and generally our counties can negotiate to that point, but sometimes you don't want to wait for that, so you need the enforced consistency across multiple communities, or if it's something that has a significant federal or a homeland security concern, where typically the state is the strong relationship in attempting to constructively work with the federal government. So those would be the particular parameters.
One last question, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Last January, I had an epidemic or pandemic or whatever you want to call it, emergency in my county, which is Yamhill County. Principally, this was in McMinnville or anybody that ate at Tommy's restaurant. I'm just vastly concerned. Had there not been one of the many, many doctors, we have, what do they call them, a hospital, where they all work different shifts, hospitalists?
A clinic?
Yes, they call hospitalists. Anyway, that's our system at our new hospital there. Had it not been for one of these doctors who began, I don't know how, putting the cases all together, we'd have never known that 26 people almost died from contaminated lettuce from this restaurant, including the owner of the restaurant, who was just couldn't believe it. But, I mean, some of these people, this was life-taking. And so I really was greatly concerned because every year I've supported a bill that requires our hospitals to report on these infectious diseases and things that go wrong, and there's no report requirement. Is that correct? Like, nobody reported this to you.
Madam,
that same vendor, excuse me, I just want to say quickly, that same vendor could have been supplying lettuce to every restaurant in the state, and nobody did anything.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I really appreciate your point. And I think I will say that the physicians in this state I find particularly responsible and thoughtful and community-oriented. But that being said, physicians in this country, unfortunately, have not been trained in medical school to their public health responsibilities to report, or even to think about not just the patient in front of them, but the community around them. And that's part of the work and the relationship. That's one of the reasons that local health departments are so important, in particular, is the relationship with the physicians. It is on the books that these should be reported. The frequency of physician reporting is very low. Laboratories are quite reliable. But that you've identified something of great concern to us as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Ashenbrenner, you've been very patient. So we'll turn to you now and hear your testimony. Thank you for being here today.
Madam Co-Chairs, my name is Thomas Ashenbrenner, and I'm here today in my role as the Chair of the Public Health Advisory Board of the Department of Human Services. And it is indeed a pleasure for me to sit next to Dr. Allen in this role because she has been a very, very important part of the work that we have done. I do appreciate the opportunity to address the committee in support of House Bill 2185, which was developed to some extent under the guidance from the Public Health Advisory Board. For more than a year, we had been listening to presentations on some of the risks and the lack of preparedness that Oregon has in addressing some of the public health risks or outbreaks here, and that public health does not have the tools or the authorities that state and local public health officials need in order to provide basic protection to our community. We believe that it is one of the fundamental responsibilities of public health and the state, as authorized by the legislature, to protect the people in communities to keep them as safe as possible. Therefore, we did endorse the Department of Human Services to go forward and develop look at the authorities that were and laws that were in place. To this end, one of our Public Health Advisory Board members, Bob Shoemaker, who some of you may recall is a former senator in the legislature and also a fine legal mind, has worked to lead this work and put together a review of the authorities, the comparison with other states, and looking at national models. And that's what has been brought before you today. Dr. Allen has identified the participants in that particular work group, but I think it's very important to say that this was developed as part of a consensus process, and while there are a number of areas that may require additional tweaking and amendments in this particular piece, that the basic principles that are being brought forward are really pretty essential to all of us here in Oregon. I think that the presence of this bill before you today is really a recognition and an awareness of the risks that we do face. And I'm delighted that each of you have acknowledged this and like the rest of us in society are aware of what happens when these things go wrong. And it's very important that you take the time to look at some of the public health authorities today. At the same time, we in Oregon are at a very unique point that we have the leadership in this state on the administrative side to actually do something very important to implement and make happen the authorities that are being proposed to you. You've acknowledged Dr. Allen's experience and role, and many of us who work in public health in this state are so appreciative of all of what she brings to us. In that, we I think that the department is willing and able to move forward, and that's a very important piece to understand. That you could pass a lot of legislation and authorize things that there wouldn't be people there to implement. In this case, you have a group of people at DHS who can actually do something with this legislation. And finally, I would just like to acknowledge that it is that the people who are the good people who know what to do and how to do it can only act when they have legislative authority to do so. And in too often we try to hold people responsible for acts for or failure to take action when they were not given the authority to take action. And that's what needs to be really addressed with this particular piece. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. One of the things that I think that needs to be said is that it's very true that we need to give authority to people and so that they feel comfortable doing it. However, I do feel that in times of real chaos, and we have Samaritans and good Samaritans, that we protect people from liability, that really just jump in and help. I don't want anybody waiting for a permit before they can come help me. And so I think that there's a balance there in what we should expect. We have not raised emergency preparedness to the level that it needs to be. And I think that those of us on the coast may be more aware, and because we understand the ocean and we have a lot of respect for the coastline. And I think that that has made some of our smaller cities more aware, and some of them have done some really good things and good planning. But I want you to be aware in the health area that we do not have 2 and 3 hospitals to choose from and a dozen doctors. And so in case of a health crisis, it may be, particularly if it's followed with or preceded by a natural disaster, we're going to be difficult for you to get to, and you're going to have difficulty in organizing us because we don't have enough health care providers. And so I hope that in your planning and thinking about us on the coast that you keep that on your radar and want to do things that are sensible in Lincoln City and Newport and Walport and Coos Bay. And even in the case of Coos Bay, they probably have more doctors and more medical facilities than some of the other smaller communities, such as Reedsport. So having said that, how about questions for Thomas Ashinger?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you very much, and thank you, Dr. Allen, again. I feel that our puzzle is starting to come together a little bit now. We've placed OEM, in Oregon Emergency Management, in a home now, and we have a bill in to fund it. And we're doing this with this bill, and we have a wonderful person who I'd entrust my life to. And we have coming up before us, not today, but soon, Senate Bill 162, an EMS trauma system, and which will put another piece of it together, which will help coalesce the whole thing. And I think what's coming together, and as we march toward this, it's incumbent of all of us on the committee to approach our co-chairs in Ways and Means with this package that we have coming forward to make our state fully prepared and putting all these pieces together, enabling it to happen, because I think it's going to become very clear to them that this is very necessary. I thank you, Dr. Allen. You probably could, you know, go to Belize or Switzerland and do something fun, but you continue to serve your state just unbelievably well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Boone. The chair recognizes Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I likewise want to thank you very much for what you're doing. My staff, this committee's tired of hearing this, but because I've worried about this so long, it was really since 9/11, I have had my staff put together all the emergency preparedness plans of all the 36 counties plus adjacent states. And the sadness of them is this: none are coordinated. So here we have, you know, this beautiful community, you know, in the state, but do we have, you know, coordination with the, you know, the cities around it that may be in different counties? Now, y'all probably do over here on the coast, because you've been through so much. We don't. We had Mount St. Helens and some strong winds, and that was it. But this morning, I was so mindful, and here we're coming here, here's this tornado, which I lived in almost all my life in Texas, but it's in Alabama and it hits a school, you know, and either the children are killed. And the good news was that the teachers had kept the kids there, you know, contrary to letting them out early because they didn't have quite enough time. It's a very sad thing. At the same time, then we see this bus that fell off the overpass with the kids, killed the baseball team, and bus driver's wife, and four of these kids were killed. And I'm thinking, you know, what would we do this morning? I mean, I'm thinking, how do we get a call? We don't put out the Amber Alert. I've been a member of Red Cross, but, you know, what's our central location? Maybe it is Ken Murphy. But does everybody know that's where you first feed the information? They said their problem, like this morning in these situations, is they get such an influx of calls, they can't answer any of them because their lines are all overused or whatever. So I'm just wondering, when something is about to happen or has happened, how do we notify the corresponding groups that would come help us?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, if I could take that question. I can't speak for all the local community plans because you may have looked at much greater breadth. I've looked more at the public health and the hospital and healthcare system plans. But I can assure you that those are coordinated. It's not to say that it's seamless, and it's not to say that all the resources are there that we need, but those have been developed in a coordinated way. The hospitals are all organized under seven healthcare emergency planning regions with our HRSA federal grant money. And they have all the planning has been done with a regional connection. And the local health departments are working with each other. Again, it may not in all cases be totally developed, but the model from the beginning was that they developed for interoperability across the regions. So, I will always be the first to say there's still far to go, but at least in the part of it that state public health and local public health have been working on, they've known from the beginning that they needed to talk with each other and share with each other. We have a very active public information and emergency alerting system at this state. It's web-based. It goes to pagers. It goes to telephones. People, we test it once a month so that, and we're hoping to get more of the medical community on that so they get it directly. A number of the local health departments have similar systems where they reach the healthcare providers in their communities. And then from the state, we actually can get messages out by blast fax to every healthcare provider in the state, including pharmacists and dentists. Within 2 hours, assuming that electricity is up. I know not all emergencies leave the electricity up, and that's something that we've had in place for at least a year, and we test quarterly. So I also agree with the issue you're talking about, the importance of having clear and prompt and accurate information. There's nothing more fundamental in an emergency, and we've done the best we can, at least within the healthcare system.
Just a quick. All right. Quote. Thank you very much, Dr.
Madam
Allen.
Chair. Madam Chair.
Yes. Oh. Representative
Kelly,
absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the issue of disaster preparedness, I just feel that I must assure the members of this committee that Lincoln County has actually done a great deal of work in disaster preparedness, and we are actually sitting in one of the most prepared cities in our county. We have Mayor Hollingsworth and City Councilor Rick Brissett back there, and they have been given an award for some of the outstanding work that they've done here in Lincoln City. So Lincoln County has taken this issue very seriously, and we always have more work to do, but we're moving ahead. What I wanted to say also before we excuse our guests here is that I want people to know just a bit more about the background and depth of knowledge and experience that Dr. Allen brought to us when she came to the state of Oregon to assume her role with the public health programs. She can speak to it better than I, but she came from some states on the east side who experienced some very significant disaster and emergent situations. So the amount of experience I have been very, very impressed as I've worked with Dr. Allen since her arrival here. And it is exciting now that since we're focusing today on the public health aspects of this, it's exciting the kind of leadership we have and the steps that we've been able to make in moving towards this particular piece of legislation. So it's going to be very exciting to be able to pass and move this bill forward, because I think it is a very big step forward for the state of Oregon, and I want to thank you for all of your work.
Thank you, Representative Cowan, and thank both of you for your testimony.
Well, thank you,
and
Madam
if you'll
Chair.
Stay close in case we have some questions that we need to call you back for.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And I want to welcome Mayor Hollingsworth. At the beginning, we asked for any elected officials in the audience, and perhaps we didn't have you here. So I'd like to give you an opportunity. Would you like to come to the table and welcome the group?
Could you repeat that? We didn't hear it.
I just happened to have a speech.
Oh, good. Well, you and Vice President Gore.
Yes,
always be ready. Thank you very much for coming to Lincoln City. I'm sorry to be late. I work for a living on top of this job that takes more time than I ever anticipated. It's a pleasure to have you here. We're going to have a ribbon cutting. I think you all know about that right after this upstairs on the fourth floor. We're very excited about that. And basically, I'll let you just get on with your meeting. It seems like this is inappropriate to continue too much here. Thank you.
Well, Mayor Hollingsworth, we are very delighted to be in Lincoln City, and I don't know of any place that we could come that we would feel more welcome, and I mean that very sincerely.
Joanne Berger?
Absolutely. I'm always welcome and feel very warm and gracious in Lincoln City, so thank you for that.
Welcome.
All right. I have Sheriff Dennis Dotson. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair.
And if you'll
give
us your name and the city in which you reside for the record.
Certainly. My name is Dennis Dotson, and for a great many people in this room, including Representative Cowan, I am their sheriff. And I reside in Newport, but I travel all over the county. Well, I'm the fly in the ointment. I really appreciate Dr. Allen's comments. And I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff Association. In reviewing the bill, everything that Dr. Allen says, no disagreement. It absolutely is a worthy piece of legislation. However, there are some concerns. In Dr. Allen's presentation, there was comments, references to people who had participated in the creation of this particular bill. I did not hear law enforcement mentioned as part of that group. There are some specific issues that we wanted to share with this committee on this particular bill regarding law enforcement. First of all, before I start on that, though, talk about some of the comments that were made favorable by Representative Cowan and some others, that in Lincoln County we do have a rather exceptional group of partners, quite a team that's come together, worked together for many years to put together pretty effective, we think, disaster plan. Also, with HRSA was mentioned just this week. I just signed up for the website. It's a great website. At the encouragement, in fact, of local public health, because we have a great relationship with public health in this county. The specific concerns have to do with the response from state and local law enforcement officials to act as the enforcement body for public health when they are decreeing that a person should be isolated, quarantined, or a piece of property should be quarantined as well. The current language in the bill is very restrictive to law enforcement. Words like must and shall are used in the response by law enforcement. The concern is that this language may be so restrictive that it takes away law enforcement executives' ability to make decisions on what responses law enforcement should be giving to all of our citizens, not just the pending emergency. That's a real concern. We feel that we need to be able to make a determination. Public health has an immediate need, obviously. Law enforcement needs to be involved in that process, very much involved in that process. Not showing up when there's food delivered to be there to provide some type of security is just not what we want to have happen. But those type of relationships, I guess, need to be developed and have been developed throughout the state of Oregon. And there's room for improvement, obviously, in many areas, if not all. Some other comments about the bill. It talks about confinement in prison, that it may not occur unless the person or group of person represents an immediate and serious danger to the staff or physical facilities of a hospital or other facility in which the person or group of persons has been confined. Well, the concern with that is that introducing someone who may be contaminated, who may need to be isolated or quarantined into an inmate population presents some interesting challenges. Corrections deputies are not trained to handle these types of situations. The facilities in this state, jail facilities, have not been constructed for this consideration. The HVAC systems, the very space where these people would have to be confined, some jails don't have it. We currently have jail overcrowding now. So it presents, again, some interesting challenges for everyone concerned, because these jails belong to the citizens, quite frankly. I mean, that's who owns them. What protective clothing or other type of training or breathing apparatus, if that's necessary, would be available for law enforcement officers that would come in contact with these people? Dr. Allen talked not only about the risk of communicable diseases, but toxins. Then in the bill, it talks about if a property is to be quarantined, for example, there's going to have to be some type of security. Just putting tape up around it isn't going to work. There's got to be somebody to make sure that has the authority and ability to keep people away from it. What protective clothing and gear are going to be made available for those people or that person? And what type of training? Who's going to pay for that? There are a number of issues that create some concerns. The health staff, we covered that. There's another section that talks about state and local law enforcement officials must assist public health director or the local public health administrator in enforcing orders issued under sections 8, 9, and 17 of this particular bill. And when one takes a look at those particular sections, it requires, again, that public health would initiate the process, obviously, but if they are unsuccessful or feel that they're not being successful, they would call upon law enforcement, and this language, again, would require a response. Certainly the law enforcement would feel a moral obligation to respond, but a lot more thought, it would appear, needs to occur as far as what is being done to train these responders to protect them. 2 years ago, Lincoln County submitted a funding request for Homeland Security for protective clothing for all emergency responders in Lincoln County. It was law enforcement, EMS, firefighters. It only totaled about $60,000, and it was denied. It wasn't approved, so we don't have the resources. Some of the fire departments, as Dr. Allen's indicated as well, are better equipped because they respond to these types of things. So they do have some clothing, but they're ill-equipped in this county, and I suspect the other 35 counties.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
A couple of sessions ago, we were talking about this very thing in a health committee, and our Representative Girard from Klamath Falls used the example of a single case of flu, influenza, or tuberculosis, and the person refused to be quarantined, and so they had to use their money to have a sheriff. Now, was that something that the sheriff had to agree to do, or was that something that was obligated because this person would not be quarantined?
Not knowing all the,
all the
details, I don't know.
Yeah, the tie between law enforcement. Now, it seemed to me that that was something that had to happen. Now, I don't know if the public health department had to have the money to pay the sheriff's salary or if that was simply pushed off to law enforcement as a responsibility. Is that kind of what you're talking about, that law enforcement?
Not necessarily. I don't feel that in an event of emergency that we should be worrying about contracting for services.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what law enforcement exists, whether it be at the city, the county, or the state level. Again, it's working out just what you're talking about to be able to a response, not necessarily who's going to pay for it, mm-hmm. but obviously there's going to be an expense. And if we are preparing plans, which is taking place, it seems that we build that into it. How can we, how can local funding authorities, how can we best position them to where they can budget for the types of things that this bill presents? And that's the issue. Not only local funding authorities, but our state funding authority, you people.
Thank you.
So there's those types of issues. There, Katrina was mentioned, and it's an example that is being used for many different purposes. Again, the law enforcement, the breakdown in that in the New Orleans area occurred for many different reasons, none of them good. But unlike a military force, civilian law enforcement is not trained nor equipped or prepared to overcome an objective through attrition. In the event of an emergency, a disaster, if the ground does shake and we all fall to the ground, everyone's going to be concerned about their loved ones. And they're going to want to know, are they okay? Are they doing what we hope they're doing? And that's seeking high ground. Police officers are going to feel the same way. And that's why local law enforcement has an obligation, responsibility to encourage their members to be prepared, to have their families prepared, and to practice that so that in the event of an emergency, a police officer doesn't have to worry that the family's okay. They know that they're going to do what they need to do, seek high ground, that they'll have the resources, emergency supplies at the home, so that the police officer can respond to the emergency to assist others. It's going to be the same thing with firefighters. It's going to be the same thing with everybody. So, again, these are just issues that need to be discussed as part of this bill. I feel that this, you know, these issues that I've brought up are very, they can be fixed very easily. And I would hope that with the information that there are amendments that are being considered, that maybe the representatives from the Chiefs Association, Sheriff's Association, State Police would have the opportunity to meet with Dr. Allen or her representatives to have a discussion, to make some proposals, to ease these concerns that exist in the current bill, and to make this a really good piece of legislation that will truly be a benefit to the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Sheriff Dodson, have you given some thought as to the structure that might take place? In other words, if you were king for a day and could choose any kind of structure that you wanted for training, not only for the people that work for you, obviously, let's say coastwide, in case of a tsunami or earthquake, what would that structure look like?
Well, it would be a partnership, first of all, and looking to the people that who possess the expertise, public health, the hospitals, medically trained staff, emergency responders, you know, fire departments have a great deal of expertise, law enforcement agencies as well, and there are probably others that would be a part of that, emergency management. Obviously, has a great deal of expertise as well. But, again, it's bringing those disciplines together, having the discussions, just as what is occurring with HRSA, as Dr. Allen talked about. You have many different disciplines coming together, including emergency management and law enforcement, to talk about what is the response going to be if something occurs, whether it's a pandemic, it's a contagion, it's a bioterrorist, or an earthquake.
Would it make any sense at all, and I don't know, and you feel free to say it doesn't make any sense to you if it doesn't. Would it make any sense at all if we had trainers that literally traveled. In other words, a trainer that came in and you organized your local people, and that individual went through intensive training and then moved on to the next community and did intensive training.
Well, that is certainly a possibility. I think that does occur now. They're in different disciplines in the medical field, public health, and law enforcement. You know, for law enforcement, we have the academy, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. There's an opportunity where some training can be introduced there, where the academy is consulting with public health to introduce a curriculum that may be of benefit to contain a HRSA component of some sort, and also the public health component. This information in this bill, again, this is a good plan. The sheriffs, the law enforcement, I can't speak for the chiefs, but the sheriffs at least feel that this needs to happen, to give public health the authority to serve the citizens in this event. Like I said, it just needs a little bit of work on the law enforcement part of it, response.
And may I address your grant application that you put into Homeland Security? Was it in the last few years?
Yes, 2 years ago.
2 years ago. And on what basis was it refused?
We're generally not given the basis for refusal. It's just that this is what's approved and...
Was not approved.
Right.
All right. And it was $60,000.
$60,000. Okay. A lot of money for us over here.
All right. Questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming, Chair. It's unfortunate to me, I guess, that the wording starts out that the Sheriff's Association opposes the bill, because I would certainly like to see a more cooperative effort in the process. And I think that we would not want to stop short of giving law enforcement the authority to do what's necessary if we're facing some of these tragic situations. So I think it's important that that component remain in the bill. I would note that the National Incident Management System is one that Dr. Allen referred to also as
right.
Public health being actively engaged. So I really think that we're all basically on the same wavelength, and I know that law enforcement is an important part of all of the planning and preparation that we do here in Lincoln County. So I guess what I'm looking for is what specifically would be your suggestion? Is it as simple as we just need to get representation from the Sheriff's Association as part of the discussion of the amendment process, or is there a specific that you think needs to happen in this particular piece of legislation?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, first of all, it does say the OSSA opposes.
It does.
Again, there's my notes to read from, but the rest of that as written for the following reasons. So, and that's been explained. But yes, I think it's just as easy as getting together representatives from local law enforcement and state. That's what's referred to in the bill.
Okay.
And have them a part of the process, and then have a discussion with the people who framed the bill so that we have a better understanding, and they have a better understanding, and we put the appropriate language in there that gives them what they need so they can do what they need to do and addresses these particular concerns that the sheriffs have. So something that we can resolve without a great deal of effort.
Follow. I think that I'd like to put on record that we all recognize that the protection of our responders in times of emergency is extremely important. We fully appreciate that people who are called upon to respond to the emergencies are putting their life on the line, and we appreciate what you do on a daily basis. And I'm certain that it's no one's intention that they not be adequately trained and protected. We certainly, however, are going to have the authority that shiny, pointy thing that you wear on your chest carries with it when we have to do something that's perhaps not going to be welcomed by all of the public. So I would certainly encourage your organization to contact Dr. Allen and her organization and make sure that the questions get answered and coordinated so that we can make this a bill that we can move forward.
And Madam Chair, Representative Callan, I appreciate your comments, and nothing in my comments, written or verbalized, should reflect that we feel there was any intention at all on this. It's just a situation where some people that could have been of great benefit are willing to come forward and work with them and partner with them, and again, make this really excellent. I mean, it's really close now.
Your comments were well-intended and well-accepted. I have said many times, and I want to say publicly again on the record, we never come up with the best decisions if we surround ourselves with people who agree with us. The best decisions are always arrived at people who have differences of opinion, and we come out with a solution that's a collaborative effort, and usually it's always, if not always, the best. The chair recognizes Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Sheriff Dodson, I'm grateful for your service. And thank you for protecting us. I think I'd just like to say this to Dr. Allen and everybody. Between your statement and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, we just about need to start over and put a new bill together. Because only one of the issues that you addressed is also on the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems list. So it seems to me that maybe we need to all come back to the table. Maybe everybody's thought about it. But I wanted to say, since 2001, I know that we may not issue any mandates on counties. So everything that says requires that you do so-and-so is null and void. And I'm just curious, though, if we had money with this bill to pay for your services in some way or an additional person who would participate when emergencies come, would you be interested?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, never say no to the offer of more funding, but yes, as far as more personnel, it's no secret to any of you that the situation in the state of Oregon, as far as being law enforcement, being able to meet the expectations of the citizens and provide the level of service that they expect and that they deserve. Not so much with your question, not so much the funding of additional personnel, but you know, for the training and the properly equipping the people that we have. That would be a great benefit, obviously. If not, again, because of the language saying that must shall, it would force local funding authorities to spend the money to prepare those people to respond to the public health director's call for assistance. That's what it would do. And I'm sure that's an unintended consequence of this thing, but that's what would happen.
All right. The chair recognizes Representative Boone.
I think I got my questions answered.
All right.
Thank you. I'll let you go ahead.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much for being here today, and always appreciate your involvement in your community. I think Sheriff Dodson is one of the most active sheriffs that I have ever known. In my travels around, everywhere that I come into Lincoln County, he's there. And that is a wonderful thing for an elected official to be such a part of the community.
We are very gracious, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Take care.
All right. We have a Tom Ebersole. While Tom is coming up, I'd like to just say we are in a public hearing. We will not be going into work session, which means that we will not be passing this bill out today. It's limited to a public hearing. All right, thank you. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Senator Berger, co-chairs, and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak today. I'm Tom Ebersole. I'm Benton County Health Administrator, just to the east of here. And I would like to speak about House Bill 2185. And I was listening to some of the other testimony, it occurred to me that shortly after I became a health administrator, I did have the opportunity to require that someone with untreated tuberculosis who was contagious and planning to leave by way of close confinement without a plane. We did have to intervene. And for me, the experience was very much like counting on an airbag in a car, and then when it came time to use it, having to unfold it myself, dust it off, get a pump, pump it up, and just watching that tractor trailer coming closer and closer in the interim. For me, the laws need to be much like an operational airbag. They need to deploy. They need to be there. They need to be ready. We need to count on them. We have to be able to move. Part of my job, in a nutshell, of course, is to protect the public health and the safety of the people in my community. And currently, our laws make it somewhat cumbersome for us to do that. Those laws are out of date and limited in their scope, quite frankly, in part because of some of the things that have unfolded since 9/11, 2001, and because the laws really weren't set up to handle that, or we just didn't think some of those through, or there were some places, I would guess, where the language was just inconsistent. Today, there are many risky situations that I'm called upon to deal with in the health of my community, and some larger emergencies that we're really not able to address under the current laws. And I think the revision of these laws and the provisions of this bill and some of the amendments really make that possible for us to do. A number of constituency groups have been working on this, most notably certainly DHS, but the Conference of Local Health Officials, and I'm a member of CLO as a member of the executive committee, and I'm here today to speak on their behalf, as well as the Association of Oregon Counties and other groups like Oregon Nurses Association who worked together on this. One of the things that I'm very appreciative of, because I worked at the state formerly and now I'm working in the county system, and I very much believe in Oregon's system of public health, which is really about having a local public health authority and serving the community very close to home. And that authority is delegated, and it's comforting for me to know that I work in a system that is backed up by a state protocol, that it can elevate to the levels of support and guidance and direction that I need. So I'm very appreciative of the respectfulness with which this has been crafted in partnership. For me, in listening to some of the other testimony as well, I'm very fortunate in that creating our local plans occurred hand in hand with our sheriff's office and law enforcement, county council, emergency management, and that we developed those hand in hand, and also with the local hospital. And one of our drills was, well, gee, if everyone's storming the hospital and a pan flu, we're expecting you, law enforcement, to surround the hospital and make it safe. And everyone started to laugh and said, well, guess again, there just aren't that many people. So we, in that conversation, we became very realistic in our expectations, but we did develop a good working relationship. When we began to drill some of this work, some of our plans that we had created, especially last November, November 1, we had a drill of our emergency management system, and I had the opportunity actually to be incident commander with the sheriff providing logistics and support and guidance to me. So depending on the emergency, the National Incident Management System allows that kind of adaptation, where whatever the issue is might take the lead and bring in the resources of government to back it up. One of the basic tenets, too, about the incident command system is being sure that those people who are at work keeping a community safe are safe themselves and protected. So I know that when I turn to our sheriff, she, and I emphasize that we're very proud that we have the first elected woman sheriff in Oregon, in Benton County, she is going to look out for her staff, and she'll let me know where the limits are of what she can do. And we, of course, would ramp up in an incident command system. In our planning across the region, because I know there's been some talk of mutual aid agreements, I think you're in a great county here, Lincoln County. It's one of our partners in the Area Trauma Board Region 2, or HRSA Region 2. We do have mutual aid agreements specifically for health care and for health emergencies among the six counties in that Region 2. One of the things this bill does, however, is it allows in times of an emergency for the public health director of the state to assure and effect, if you will, some standards across jurisdictions if that's necessary. While we have those mutual aid agreements, somebody in Lane County at the moment doesn't have that mutual aid agreement with us. And that's something that, if the emergency ramped up, could be assured by this law. And we could get that kind of guidance and support from the state. Again, this law addresses some of the definitions of emergency and what situations might require cross-jurisdictional efforts. You may well remember the E. coli outbreak in Lane County related to the fair. And while that wasn't a declared emergency, we had been contacted by our partner health department in Lane County saying, our nurses are just running ragged. They're doing all that they can. Do you have some nurses that you can share with us? Didn't have a mutual aid agreement, but we said, you bet, we'll be there. Just let us know. But that wasn't a declared emergency. I'm convinced I have good partners all around me in counties that surround me, but should extraordinary resources be necessary, this bill would also allow for some coordination of that across jurisdictions. I've given you some handouts. My testimony was really to go through some of those bulleted points, but I think they've been mentioned, so I will kind of skip those. But I think the bill does allow some clarity in the defining the positions and the authority that goes with those positions, specifically the authority to create policy and the authorities to administer policy. And I think that is some language clarification that CLO has been very interested in, where the terms around authority had been simply applied to numbers of different positions. And that has been clarified by some collaborative work between CLO and the Department of Human Services, and they are in agreement with our proposed amendments. The legislation, I believe, is critical to the successful functioning of our public health system on our day-to-day operations and our emergency operations. Our idea behind surge capacity is that we will ramp up, if you will, or sort of put onto steroids, what it is that we do every day, just like the communicable disease reporting that goes either through laboratories or through public health departments to the state where it's coordinated, and we might know that there's something going on in a neighboring jurisdiction. The way we can make those more robust and then reinforce them in an emergency situation is what we would propose for surge capacity. And this will help us instill that kind of capacity to surge.
Mr. Eversole, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap in the essence of time. Thank you.
You bet.
Madam Chair.
Yes. If you don't have a pressing question, we are going to move on. I'm going to allow Representative Boone to ask her question.
Oh, and it is pressing. But I just wanted to let you know that this committee did pass a statewide mutual aid bill. Don't recall the number of it right now, but if it's locality, it's my understanding, if you have one here, you have partially one there. It doesn't change your agreement, but it allows for it. So you're covered.
Great. Good news.
All right. Thank you very much for being here and for your testimony. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2185. We have a change of the guard. And also, we're going to try to get Senator Johnson on the phone.
That's right.
Who are we going to try and get? Okay. All right. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 432. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 432 allows shipbreaking in Oregon only in dry dock. It prohibits shipbreaking in the territorial sea, at pier, or dismantling slip. It would declare an emergency effective upon passage. You have before you on the dais the -1 amendments. Those amendments define ship to mean a vessel that weighs in excess of 200 tons and operates upon navigable waters. You'll see also a definition for shipwreck. And it does define waters of the state, and I have provided you with the ORS Chapter 196 reference, so you see the meaning of that defined in statute, because the amendment also deletes the reference to Oregon's territorial sea and replaces it with that reference to the waters of this state. The Dash 1 amendments also allows a person to dismantle a ship that has been shipwrecked in the waters of the state for purposes of removal if the Department of State Lands determines that it is physically impracticable to move the shipwreck to dry dock. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Madam Co-Chair, as chief sponsor of the bill, I'm going to remain at the dais and make my presentation.
It's fine with me.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, I'm Joanne Berger, Oregon Senator, representing the beautiful coastal District 5 that has a western boundary from Coos Bay to Lincoln City, encompassing parts of six counties. In 2006, a shipbreaking company approached the port of Newport, seeking a place to break up old ships, many that were resting off the San Francisco harbor. Being turned down by the port following public opposition, eyes turned to the Coos Bay area. Oregon's law at the present time would allow such activity without the dry dock requirement that California requires. Concerned that the promise of some economic benefit might persuade a struggling community to accept such a venture, releasing asbestos, wastewater, and invasive species into our bays and streams, I have introduced Senate Bill 432 to assure all Oregonians that we can protect our waterways and still allow good economic progress with bills like this one. Since I introduced this bill, I have realized that there was a need for a few amendments. First, after speaking with the Oregon Marine Board, it became apparent that a definition of ship was necessary. Currently, the Marine Board is dismantling small local ships, and that does not need to be done in a dry dock. The second amendment will allow the dismantling of a shipwreck if state lands determines it is physically impractical to move the shipwreck to dry dock. Finally, my amendment will use waters of this state rather than territorial sea because territorial waters only go from the coastline out 3 miles. Instead, waters of this state will cover both out 3 miles and inland on all natural waterways. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I ask for your support of Senate Bill 432. All right. Do I have a list, please, of those who would like to testify? All right. I will call up Range Bayer. Is that correct?
Judith?
Yes, Senator Johnson.
May I just introduce myself that I'm on the phone and thank the chair for the courtesy of being able to join this way?
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Can you hear us all right?
I heard your very compelling testimony, Madam Chair, and I am deeply appreciative that you have afforded me the opportunity to advocate on this bill with you.
Very good. And if you would like to make comments or ask questions, feel free to do so.
Thank you. I deeply appreciate your courtesy in allowing me to join the committee this way. It provided me the opportunity to do something I desperately needed to do in my district and still be there with you in Lincoln City in an advocacy role for this very important bill.
All right. Welcome to the dais.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Range Bayer, and I live in Newport, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 432. I do so because shipbreaking is an ongoing issue. I don't think it's been solved just by, in the last 2 years with the Bay Bridge Enterprises signing out to in Newport. So I think it's going to be an ongoing issue, and there currently are inadequate regulations for shipbreaking in Oregon. I think it is important that shipbreaking be done with the least risk of spilling hazardous materials or introducing invasive species, and I think shipbreaking is the best way to do so. I realize there's a large crowd today, so I think in my written testimony, starting on page 14 going to the end, I have pictures of shipbreaking in water, either at a pier or in a slip. And if you're, when, as you look through the pictures, It makes it clear why the importance of dry dock. With dry dock, you can contain hazardous materials that are in the ship, but when you're doing it in a slip, like you look in the first picture on page 14, it shows cranes moving scrap from the ship in a slip over water to land. And in a dry dock, this would be all contained. There's always a possibility of when you're moving scrap from a ship to land that part of the scrap can fall into the water. The next picture shows part of the hull missing on a ship. Next couple pictures. And the problems with that is that you're cutting the hull, and the actual process of cutting involves slag from the cutting torches that can also go into the water. And particularly here on the Oregon coast, we, as you know how stormy it's been today, we have a problem of wind blowing. It can blow debris that's loose inside into the water, whereas if you have it in a dry dock, that would be contained. The picture on page 17 shows the boom at the back of the slip. A problem, particularly like when it was talked about in Newport, is it was not really a slip. It was more closely to being a pier. And it was right adjacent, some of the ships would be right adjacent to the channel, and then a cove was right next to the channel. And a boom would not be very effective, especially when we're having storms, when you got tides. Our tidal conditions and tidal currents are much stronger than in areas such as in Virginia, where Big Bridge Enterprises was proposing to do theirs. And the boom is designed to capture oil or other loose debris. So dismounting the ship in a dry dock, you wouldn't have the problem of the boom becoming ineffective during a storm. Picture in the next page again shows the hull being cut. Again, it's in water. And the next picture on page 19 shows that Bay Bridge Enterprises in Virginia, they actually have a tracked vehicle in the water, in the slip, and you can notice the bow of the boat has been completely off. You know, the possibility of loose materials blowing into the water or the introduction of contaminated materials, even from the tracked vehicle, is a problem. Basically, I think dry docks is important because it can contain the loose material, and this includes paint chips that are on some of the obsolete ships from the U.S. Maritime Administration fleet near San Francisco, which will be probably the primary source of vessels that will be talked about for being scrapped. So dry docks can contain this. It can also contain, I think, better contain the transfer of bilge water. Bilge water itself can be contaminated as it soaks down to the bottom of the hull. Particularly here on the Oregon coast, we have a lot of rain like today where we cut the decks off. That water is going to go down to the bottom of the ship. To transfer that, you're going to have to pump it out over the water to land, whereas if you do it in a dry dock, it's all contained. So your possibilities of containment are so much better in dry dock. Also,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
What happens to the water then on land that you take out? You're going to put that in enclosed containers and take it somewhere. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that would be the ideal situation for doing it. I know in Cascade General, which is a ship, they work with ships and have a dry dock in Portland. For their dry dock, they actually, and they dismantled two fishing boats, they had their own wastewater treatment. So they treated it on site, and in the whole, you know, it's all contained on site with their treatment. They actually have a treatment center for their dry dock.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Senator Johnson,
yes, ma'am.
While you don't have the benefit of pictures, we will be bringing you the handout that Mr. Bayer has brought. And they are very concerning about ship breaking that is not in dry dock. And he's given great testimony in favor of the bill.
I'm able to hear the testimony very well. Frankly, no one spoke as loudly or as clearly as you, but I'm able to hear the testimony very well and follow it.
Very good. Continue on, Mr. Bayer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last point I'd like to make is about fighting fires. This is an issue in scrapping ships because they use cutting torches, and there still remains some flammable materials. on board and a fire can start. In fact, at Bay Bridge Enterprises, they had a fire this last October. And why it's an issue is in terms of contamination, you're using water to put out the fire. If there's any water sprayed on the outside, if there's any loose paint chips, which can be toxic because they contain lead, they're going to go into the water. The air problem is that the water can go down and create more bilge water that can be contaminated. So you have the problem of pumping it out again, whereas if you have it in dry docks, it's all contained. So I'm very much in favor of this bill to the dry dock portion. And one thing I would like to see as a near amendment in considering it in the last few days, I come to realize that when we think of shipbreaking, we generally just think of the process of dismantling a ship. But there's also a little bit more involved, especially for U.S. Maritime Administration vessels that have been moored for some of them up to 35 years near San Francisco, is the fouling organisms that's on the ship. When they're actually in the dry dock that's proposed, they're going to be protected. But it's the transport from wherever they are through Oregon waters to the shipbreaking site, and then oftentimes these ships are being moored near the site before they would go into the dry dock as proposed. And I would like to see something in for an amendment to include the process of no hazardous materials or invasive species entering Oregon waters while the ship is transported, or at least while it's moored near the shipbreaking site.
Mr. Baer, I'm going to call to the podium David Martin, my policy advisor. We have looked into this, and David will tell you what we have found out about that problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You'll introduce yourself for the committee, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is David Martin, and I am Senator Berger's policy advisor. In regards to the ships and the fouling communities on them, right now the Maritime Board, the MARAD, is responsible for cleaning the vessels before they are transported. As of right now, there is some concern that it hasn't been occurring. At the local level, the U.S. Coast Guard does have authority over it as well. One of the issues with putting an amendment in that would require the cleaning of the hull beforehand is it would have to be very specific because it could have some unintended consequences on the commercial fleets that are coming through because those are moving at such a high rate. And because they're not sitting for very long, they're not getting these fouling communities at a level that is going to affect the port of Coos or any of the other ports.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Just reference to the letter that came from Robert Cook, Executive Director from Texas Parks and Rec. And this letter is a real indictment of ships coming in near territorial water to be scraped, and what a lousy job they're doing. So, and I don't know how we guard against that unless we just don't let them come or make sure that they're clean before they get anywhere near the place.
All right. Thank you, David. Thank you, Mr. Baer. I'm going to move on. We have quite a list of people to testify today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's great to have this opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll call up Marvin Turner.
Thank you, Chairman and committee. I feel kind of privileged getting a letter in the mail to come here at this meeting. And it is a big concern for me because I love the League of Cities clear from 1958.
Madam Chair,
I need you to identify yourself.
Oh, yeah, I'm Marvin Turner, a resident of Lincoln City and proud of it.
Welcome, Marvin.
But the thing is, I'm going to be in Lincoln Beach this spring, and I'm not going to be too happy about that because my house will only be 57 feet from the ocean, and the foam does come into the yard when there's high tide. So when the tsunami hits, I hope you have a good warning system. Let me know, because that kind of obviously walls of water come out like that, and I go, you know. So anyway, about the shipping, my biggest about this whole thing is location of it. You know, the dry docking. Because if you don't have a good location and there's a tsunami, no matter if it's dry docked, there could be a, all that stuff that you're talking about be just be a disaster in the, in our local area. Mm-hmm. And but the idea of dry docking and having debris landing in the water is a lot better. I'm for it. I'm for it because I've been around Astoria. Tom Point, where the Navy base was, all the rusted ships that used to go out that the Germans, I think, took. And a lot of the ships, so when I saw the ship being out on the water in Coos Bay area, I saw that on the news when they were tearing that apart. And now you got this debris and all that stuff on half of a hull sitting on the beach and everything, and this, you know, unsightly. And all that stuff getting into the water, oil, whatever the debris is, it's this pollution itself. So this dry docking, having material off of the water and having it, like he mentioned, a confined area, is great. And also this water that he says that, like it's like, first thing that came to mind, the same thing. It's like sewage, you know, plant, water treatment. Having it confined where it doesn't get into the ocean, not into our drinking water, not into our area, it'd be really great. So I'm ready for this whole thing.
Thank you, Marvin. It was good to have you here today.
Good job.
I'm going to call two of you now at a time. It doesn't mean you have to agree. It just means that we'll move a little faster. Joanne Barton and Mike, is it Beckett? Welcome, both of you. Joanne, if you'll start and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Joanne Barton, and I'm here as a private citizen, but also as a representative of Friends of Yukona Bay.
I'm Mike Becker from Newport. It seems like we are meeting quite consistently lately. I have been a member of Friends of Yukona Bay, and I think it's absolutely appropriate that Joanne and I be here together because I know what she plans to say, and I plan on flushing it out and backing her up. From my viewpoint...
Can I get to go first?
Yes. Thank you for introducing this bill. It's something that has been badly, badly needed on the coast, as last year pointed out. Joanne, go ahead.
Once again, thank you. The Friends of Yukona Bay commend you for this proposed legislation, and we support your efforts regarding Senate Bill 432. And we base that support and commendation on our experience and the education that we received, much of it self-education, during the Port of Newport's consideration of locating a shipbreaking operation on Yukona Bay during 2005 and 2006 holiday season. And we respectfully offer the following recommendations and comments, which you'll see in writing. I won't go into all of them specifically, but as you can see, the comprehensive general liability of $5 million for a single occurrence, bodily injury and property damage, $5 million in aggregate, sudden and accidental pollution liability of $5 million per occurrence, and asbestos and lead abatement liability of $2 million per occurrence. We feel these are woefully inadequate, and that at a minimum these should be at 10 times the levels that are put forth, and at best 20 times the level that are put forth. There is no mention of PCBs, oil, or coal tar. Those would fall under that B, sudden and accidental pollution liability. And, of course, as I said, we feel that the liability limits are far too low. The contract between MARAD and the shipbreaking company state that the federal government, quote, shall be indemnified and held harmless against any and all loss, cost, damage, claim, expense, or liability whatsoever. Therefore, again, stressing the importance of increasing these liability limits. There further are liability limits for towboat companies and tugboat company coverage requirements. General liability at $5 million. Collision liability at $5 million, tow vessels at $5 million each. the Marine Protection Indemnity Liability for the Towboat Companies and Tugboat Companies, Sudden Accidental Pollution, Collision, Removal of a Wreck, Third-Party Damages from Movement of Obsolete Vessels, only $10 million per occurrence. Our comments. The Coast Guard statistics reveal over 2,400 vessel undertow accidents on the West Coast between 1980 and 2005. The Ghost Fleet vessels have sat in moorage with minimal maintenance for decades and in some cases over half a century. They'll be towed dead stick. In other words, they will be completely reliant on towboats and tugboats to their destinations for salvage. We're confident the experience of Senator Verger and the state of Oregon regarding the new CARISA proved these liability levels woefully inadequate and deficient. I think that the last I heard, salvage operations on the new CARISA exceeded $150 million, and perhaps you have a more recent total. One accident alone, of course, could easily run into hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on the severity. Further, a wreck left blocking a channel or a jetty entrance could create economic loss liability to coastal commerce well beyond the cost of simply mitigating the wreckage. And then for under MARAD bonding requirements, performance bonding coverage is set forth by MARAD is simply addressed in one paragraph. Insurance levels, again, are inadequate and provide very little protection for Oregon communities. Depending, and this is quoting from MARAD's performance bonding coverage documents, depending on ghost ship salvaging experience on previous MARAD contracts and total dollar value of a new contract under or over $1 million per contract, the performance bonding requirement varies from $150,000 to $500,000 per vessel. This is simply inadequate. Bonding levels must be set higher to realistically protect the public from contract performance failure. If and when an accident occurs or the financial viability of a ship salvage company becomes an issue, the communities to which these ghost vessels have been towed will, in fact, become their new owners. These insurance and bonding issues were of grave concern during the Newport experience with Baybridge Enterprises, the shipbreaking company that proposed to locate on Yaquina Bay. I think this is very important. Baybridge Enterprises is a subsidiary of a chain of subsidiaries and offshore holding companies stretching globally to the parent company in India, Adani Exports Limited. The primary purpose of constructing corporations in such a manner is to create tax benefits and liability firewalls. They are not constructed to protect communities in which these corporations operate. And then further, I would just like to close by saying there are some sorts of potential damage that are irrevocable, and that would be irreversible, such as protected or endangered species extinction, which no amount of monetary compensation can redress. Accordingly, we would hope that Senate Bill 432 would require that there be available backup towing resources within some reasonable response latency. For an example, if a working towboat malfunctions or if conditions deteriorate beyond its level of competence, there should be a replacement available to reach it in X amount of hours, X being the number of hours it would take the hulk of a ghost vessel to drift onto the shore. Therefore, if a towboat breaks down and it would take 24 hours for the hulk to drift aground, there should be no leg of the route that is more than 20 hours away from a spare towboat. Again, we are very happy to support your efforts, very grateful that you're bringing this to the Senate, and if there is any way that we can be of any further assistance, we hope that you'll contact us.
Joanne, I greatly appreciate your testimony, and I think that perhaps this bill is the first step. It sounds to me like there's some other things that need to be put in place in other bills. Mike?
Yeah. I wanted to flesh out a little bit what Joanne talked about. To give you some background, prior to becoming involved in fishing or in the conjunction with that, I spent 35 years in the marine insurance business. And at the time the new CARISA went on the beach, our state representative at the time, Terry Thompson, asked me if I would work with Governor Kitzhaber's legal staff, and advising them on just insurance issues relative to the new CARISA. What Joanne said about the new CARISA was very apropos. The last hard figures I had, and I knew virtually all of the claims people working on the new CARISA, they had paid over $135 million in a combination of removal of wreck and pollution liability and third-party liability claims. This was prior to reaching settlement with the state of Oregon for leaving the balance of it there. Where I want to go with this, I am going to request that, if possible, we add an amendment to the bill requiring at least $50 million limits of liability. Why I'm getting to that number is that there are several extremely hazardous situations that this brings up. You have to remember, these vessels are coming to the coast under tow. In answer to Senator Morissette's questions, are these vessels inspected prior to departure? They are to an extent. MARAD requires that they be surveyed. That is a visual inspection. They do not go into the tanks on those vessels. They have no real concrete information as to exactly what is inside. They know there are some hazardous materials, but Gene, I can't remember the exact figures from the Port of Newport. We had a concrete ship that's been part of a dock there for 50 years that I believe leaked 250 gallons of oil into the bay at Newport, and if I remember correctly, the cleanup cost was close to $500,000. You know, and I'm not certain, but that's a number that sticks. I know it's extremely expensive to get into that type of thing. The vessels, while they're being towed to the coast, are inherently hazardous. They are light. They have no ballast in them. The companies that are bringing them up to break them are doing it trying to minimize costs, so they're going to hire the cheapest towboat firm they can find. You get into a situation, as Joanne discussed, and what we had talked over when we looked at it in Newport. Newport has several features, and I think, Senator Verger, you'd find the same thing in Coos Bay. There are certain industries in the bay that are really susceptible to damage from this type of thing. Newport has oyster beds, as does Coos Bay. We also have the Marine Science Center, which they thought if there were serious damage and they had to shut down all of their research because of bad water in the bay, conceivably we would have been looking at about $35 million in loss right there. Plus we have the Oregon Coast Aquarium, which is a $10 million bonded debt to the city of Newport. So if you start doing serious damage to these, we're talking big dollars. $5 million would be an appropriate deductible. Now, there are only three points of entry that you're going to bring these vessels into the coast. You've got Newport, you've got Coos Bay, and the Columbia River. Newport and Coos Bay are both susceptible to damage from this type of thing. I've been on the bay at Newport when they've had 135-knot winds in them and broken ships and boats loose. And it will be ugly. The Columbia River, Debbie, you've seen the charts with the wrecks around the mouth of the Columbia. It's the most hazardous entrance in the world. You know, we're talking serious liabilities. What she has said about the insurance coverages in here is absolutely correct. I'm familiar with the MARAD requirements. What they require in terms of coverage is absolutely appropriate. My only objection is with the limits of liability. The problem we have with that is that if, say, you bring a ship into the harbor at Newport or into Coos Bay, and those limits of liability are not adequate, the burden for paying for that loss falls on the taxpayers, I believe, first of the port and second of the state. So what I'm asking for in higher limits is intended to protect the taxpayers of this state. You know, I absolutely agree with everything that's being said about breaking them in dry dock. It is the only thing that makes sense. But I think, you know, again, my suggestion is, and I don't know if we can put it as an amendment to this bill or something to look at in the future, but I would consider or request that you consider looking at much higher limits. And again, it's for the protection of the taxing districts and the taxpayers of the state.
All right, Mike, Jordan,
thank you.
I appreciate your bringing that to our attention very much. And I'm going to ask you, let me move on now to the next. We have a long list.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm going to call Greg Harlow and Louise Soliday. Welcome. Who would like to begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And thank you for the opportunity to address you today regarding Senate Bill 432. My name is Greg Harlow, resident of Newport, and I appear on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We're an Oregon nonprofit comprised of thousands of anglers dedicated to enhancing and protecting fisheries and their habitats for today and the future, and that is our mission statement. The Northwest Steelheaders applaud your work on SB 432 to protect all the waters of our state. We have worked with other stakeholder groups to propose many of the amendments that you have already adopted, and several of the others that you've heard about this afternoon. Invasive species are a significant threat, and should the federal rules be repealed, we would ask that SB 432 include similar language to protect our bays and estuaries from those threats. The current MARAD liability coverage requirements don't reflect real-world mitigation, and I think that you've heard that from Mr. Becker. There's a reason why Californians don't want these ships disassembled where they sit, and they're very adamant about it. The threat to their waterways, their groundwater, and their flora and fauna are just too great. The contaminated runoff from these vessels pose a more significant threat, and we would like to suggest that roof structures be a part of this dry dock containment. As you know, Oregon experiences torrential rains, especially here at the coast, and much of it is sideways rain. That rain's going to hit these contaminated decks and blow right over into the areas that are not contained. And that's going to go right back out into the groundwaters. It's going to affect the fish. It's going to affect the crab. The containment issue was really downplayed quite a bit during the Bay Bridge fiasco in Newport. And I would just like to point an example that every year, because of our rains, millions of gallons of raw sewage wash out of our municipality's wastewater treatment plants. We have no control over that. It flows right into our waterways where our children play, and it's an issue that really needs to be closely looked at. The cancer-causing agents that are closely associated with shipbreaking are much greater than raw sewage. They have a much longer-term effect and pose a greater risk to our public health over a much longer period of time. So complete containment should be a requirement. We should also consider increased holding facilities for the chemicals and rainwater runoff that come from these dry docks so that we do not have to worry too much about them washing over the edges and out into the waterways. We look forward to further development and working with your committee on SB 432. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harlow. Senator Johnson?
Yes,
Senator Johnson, Director Soliday is here, and We'll have three other presenters. Will you be able to stay with us?
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much. All right. Director Soliday, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. I want to speak to the Dash 1 amendment in particular. We had submitted an amendment to Co-Chair Verger to address a concern we had about whether the original Senate Bill 432 prevented the removal of shipwrecks off of Oregon's coast. And so most of what we submitted was became part of the Dash 1 amendments. However, I want to raise a little bit of a, I'll call it a yellow flag instead of a red flag, about the new Section 3. And that is the section that now says that the Department of State Lands is going to make a determination about whether it's physically impracticable to move a 200-ton ship from where it is. That's not an area where the Department of State Lands has expertise, unless I have some unknown expertise in my staff that I'm not aware of. It is normally the Coast Guard who would make that sort of determination, particularly in coastal waters. I'm not sure exactly how to address that issue. I looked at this for the first time today when I got here, and so I want to think about that and talk with my staff about how we might I get the issue that we're trying to address there. It's just that we don't have the expertise to make that determination about whether something that large is movable or not. It also would take considerable resources for us, depending on where that wreckage might be located in the territorial sea. It's a little easier if it's in Coos Bay or Yaquina Bay or the estuary of the Columbia. But when you're talking about the territorial sea, you're talking about a fairly large area. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And as I said, we're willing to work with the committee to sort of figure out how to address the issue that's
well,
in
I brought
Section
that
3.
Up. And the drafter of the bill wanted to state it that way. And I thought that perhaps it was because when ships come in, many times if they wreck, they're wrecking on your land.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I would say that we are experts in determining when someone is trespassing on our property.
Right, right.
We do own the submerged and submersible lands of the territorial sea, navigable waterways, and tidally influenced waterways, and so we are experts in making a determination whether somebody is trespassing.
Right.
But whether something can be moved or not is a whole other matter and something which we do not have expertise in.
Are you comfortable keeping the amendment as is, even though at the time that you would have to make that determination, you would bring in the expertise of the Coast Guard?
Madam Chair, if somebody wants to give us the resources to do that when that happens, I think we could live with it. It's not often that you have something that's that large that's going to wreck. Hopefully the new Carissa is not going to happen with any regularity or frequency on Oregon's coast. And we may be able to live with it. I just want the committee to be aware this is not our area of expertise. We're not funded to make those kinds of calls, and it could be very expensive to try and make those kinds of calls.
I think Legislative Council wanted you very much at the table, though, in that area, and it's because that it is your land, and they didn't want to usurp your authority there. And so that's the reason I'm asking, and I questioned it, but that was pretty much what they were looking out for you, I think, in that regard. So are there any questions of Director Soliday? All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And I'm going to call Brian Fuller and Paul Engelmeyer. All right, who would like to go first?
Go ahead.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Fuller. I'm here from Eugene, representing the Department of Environmental Quality. We're here to answer any questions you may have, provide some information, and offer our support for Senate Bill 432. As you've heard, there's been a couple shift-breaking proposals in Oregon. My involvement was the Coos Bay through my representing DEQ on the governor's economic revitalization team. The Port of Coos Bay and the South Slough put together a public forum on environmental issues regarding shipbreaking. Without having a specific proposal, some of the areas of concern that we identified would be the asbestos removal and disposal, wastewater management, you know, such as bilge water, the ballast water, storm water, construction stormwater management, if a dry dock or graving dock was constructed, oil and fuel removal, hazardous waste management, spill preparedness and response, PCBs, and whole fouling or invasive species. The benefit that we see to the dry dock would be containment. You know, it offers a greater level of containment for potential contaminants or hazards that can be captured in the dry dock, removed and treated if need be. While no shipbreaking facility was located from the port's efforts in Coos Bay, you know, one of the outcomes that did occur was there was a interagency work group created consisting of DEQ, Department of Agriculture, Fish and Wildlife, Land Conservation and Development, State Lands, Economic and Community Development, the Oregon Invasive Species Council, Oregon Institute of Marine Biology, the Port of Coos Bay, Portland State University, and the South Slough Research Reserve. One of the conclusions that was reached by this work group was that a dry dock or that equivalent would provide the best containment and therefore protection of Oregon's lands and waters. This proposed statutory requirement would create that authority. I don't know that it exists currently. And it would also convey to industry that's looking to locate here what the playing field is, what the requirement would be if they do choose to locate a shipbreaking facility here in Oregon. No shipbreaking facilities exist on the West Coast, and if one were to look at Oregon, we would support a dry dock requirement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fuller. Quite honestly, I think we came very close to perhaps having someone move seriously into the shipbreaking off the coast of Oregon, because I think that when you come to small communities that are desperate for jobs and need jobs brought in for economic development, there is a tendency to not think as seriously about what that company might be bringing, and it was strong motivation for me to sponsor this bill. All right, and now we have Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Committee. My name is Paul Engelmeyer. I'm a resident of Yahats, Lane County, and I'd like to testify in favor of SB 432 with a few caveats, and most of them have already been drawn attention to. I'd like to just reiterate just a couple of the items. Of course, the amendments related to waters of the state, that was a good move to do that, bring that forward. And dealing with this idea of something that was brought up is this performance bonding and liability. I think that that's something that warrants review. Is it adequate? What track records do we have in other examples around the United States? I think it's something we could look at. Some of us believe it isn't adequate, and I think that that's something would be warranted. The other issue that is drawn attention and has been is this issue of oversight of who and the chain of command and responsibility. And so that's something that I, of course, would like to make sure it's clear. We all see we've got a legacy in Yaquina Bay of a Superfund site. None of us want that to happen again. And that's really a sequence of oversight that could have been prevented. We waited too long before we responded. And, of course, complete containment is really the key, a closed system. And I think if that's something that the Coos Bay direction move that issue forward, I think that that's something that we really, really support. I've got a couple of other items I would like to draw attention to, though. And one of them is related to the leadership dealing with legislation for seafloor mapping.
I really appreciate that. I think that this is really leadership that we need right now in state waters. We really appreciate that. And that effort will, of course, help in a number of activities, whether it is tsunami readiness, conservation planning, or wave energy park. So I'm very pleased that that is out and for discussion. The next item I'd like to draw attention is I'm a member of the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. I'm the statewide conservation rep. And under the direction of the governor's office, there was a clear direction to deal with what do we need to move forward with this network design of marine reserves. Okay, and so that direction came to OPAC, I guess it's actually been a year ago, and OPAC's been struggling with it, but we're very close to having a draft budget timeline and work plan, and I'm hoping that this committee would be willing to have some folks come in and talk about the issue and walk you through it. Of course, it would be state agency, someone from OSU potentially, and some members from OPAC. So I think that something would be appropriate. I, of course, would support that.
Well, that's very timely because Representative Boone and I are sponsoring a meeting on March the 6th, and everyone is invited to show Common Ground, the film, and then to have a panel discussion.
Great.
And Terry Thompson will be there. And so your wish has come true.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And as far as supervision, I think the gentleman right next to you would be happy to give you some reassurance that as far as containment and so forth, when the dry docking takes place, that it would that he will be right there observing and watching. So thank you both for your testimony.
You.
And last, we'll have Rolla Cleaver. And Joe, I was wondering if you were going to come up, Joe.
Very much. Go ahead, Bob.
Am I first?
Yeah, you're first.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll try to be brief. I'm not a scientist. My name is Rolla Cleaver. I live in South Beach, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Lincoln County chapter of the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. And I want to voice support for your efforts that would restrict the shipbreaking industry from all Oregon waterways. For those of us who live in the Newport area, share your concern about how close we came to having this industry in Yaquina Bay. And it causes me great concern that a small group of people focused on purely economic issues can make decisions that can have devastating economic as well as environmental impact on an entire region for decades. It does give me some comfort that the people who represent us are up here supporting this piece of legislation, and for that I say thank you. And I'd also like to voice support for the previous comments regarding the size of the liability issues in the legislation. And thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. All right, Joe.
Chair Verger, Chair Boone. My name's Joe Rollator. I live on the south end of this county. You're on the north end of Lincoln County right now. I'm here today as a citizen and not in my regular job as a lobbyist. I'm also on the steering committee of the Lincoln County steering committee of the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. And a lot of people in this county got really motivated about the shipbreaking. We feel very, very strongly about the quality of our environment, almost all fish. And, you know, invasive species are a real problem that we all need to address. And they've been with us for a long time. We all have a clam in the bay that we call a softshell clam. Representative Boone probably calls a Neatarts clam. And in your area, they call it an empire clam. And it came in way over 100 years ago, maybe as much as 200 years ago, in the ballast of a ship in the mud. And actually, they're really good to eat. But it always amazes me to think about what might be there if the eastern blues weren't there. So they pushed out some native species, and that happens all the time, but we really want to slow that down. I do have one technical suggestion on the amendment. In line 2 of the dash 1 amendment, I believe that you might want to say 200 gross tons. All of our boats have a certificate, and it's always in gross tons. As an example, the charter boat I run in Kodiak is 90 feet long, and she says she's 112 gross tons on the certificate of that vessel. So the fishing fleet tries to register their boats at under 200 gross tons. The charter fleet tries to register their boats as under 100 gross tons. So there's a good break there at 200 gross tons. You're not going to get into the daily operation of our working boats in our bay. You're going to hit the boats that are brought in for this purpose of being salvaged. So thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate it very much. Thanks
thank
again
you.
For coming to Lincoln County.
Thank you very much for being here. Senator Johnson.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Johnson, being a strong sponsor of this bill, I'd like to give you an opportunity to say anything you would like to say.
No, Madam Chair. I think your testimony covered the rationale behind the bill, and I wish to have my opinion associated with your remarks. I would be, not knowing if you have a quorum and if you're going to work this bill, I would be privileged to offer an amendment, a motion. But I don't know if you're going to go into work session.
Well, that's what we've been discussing here among us as to whether to go into work session today. And I think that we should do that while we're here in Lincoln City and have it dedicated to this one of these wonderful coastal communities that came close to having disastrous ship breaking without a dry dock. So I would certainly entertain a motion. That's right. I've got to close the public hearing and open a work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Do you have someone else you want to? Okay. I move we adopt Senate Bill 432 and move it to the floor with a.
We have to adopt the amendment.
Oh, the amendment
dash
first.
One amendment first.
I move we adopt the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 432.
Representative Nelson moves that the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 432 be adopted. Is there any discussion? Question?
The last comment that we heard about, should that read gross ton? I don't know the verbiage well enough to know, but I just thought I'd raise that question. It's your amendment, I guess.
All right. I think that we're safe.
Okay.
I think we're safe.
All right.
Okay. I will entertain another motion, Representative Nelson.
Oh. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It's
No, I'll wait until the motion.
Okay. It's my privilege today to move that we accept Senate Bill 432 as amended and move it to the Senate floor.
Okay, let me go back just a minute.
Okay.
We have a motion. Representative Nelson moves that the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 432 be adopted. The discussion came from Representative Cowan. For the record, is there any objection? If not, so ordered. Now, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 432. I move we adopt Senate Bill 432
as amended.
And move it
to the floor.
Henceforth to the floor.
Do
with
pass.
A due pass
recommendation
from this great committee.
All right. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Morsett.
We've come to the coast to hear a very important bill. We've listened to testimony that is not included in the bill. My concern is we're going to pass a bill. I know there's going to be another liability bill, perhaps, and that's okay, and I'm willing to follow the chair's lead on this, but I just want to be sure that we didn't come all the way down here to hear testimony that we're not going to act upon. And I think that there have been a number of excellent suggestions that need to be in a bill, an additional bill. I don't know why we don't put it in this bill. But I just wanted to raise that issue, but I will support your efforts.
The bill also will have an opportunity back at the committee, but I would like to say that I do believe that the suggestions that are today deserve another bill. I believe the liability issue was major, and I think that we certainly need to look at that. This bill simply says if you're going to break up a ship in Oregon, you are going to dry dock it. And that's all it says. We had to clarify a few things so that it would be clear, but it's not a complicated bill at all. However, I think that there are other bills that will relate to this bill very much. So, all right, I'm going to have the clerk roll call the roll. Those of the opinion that Senate Bill 432, as amended, be sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation shall vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 The bill passes. Next, we're going to have. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. I want this group who are here today, the group that is here today, to know how blessed we are at the legislature to have these distinguished individuals that you see here. I've known Senator Berger since the first day we both began, and she's just been incredible.
Thank you.
Working both sides of the aisle, just giving us her professional, excellent advice from her vast experience, and she is absolutely incredible. And I just wanted you to know that.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Let's recognize her. And next, because they're all part of this area, and I don't want to let any of them not know that we appreciate them all, but Senator Johnson and Representative Boone, Representative Cowan, and Senator Morissette, who I've also worked with, are likewise just so concerned about your issues. Work unbelievably hard, and you're so blessed, so we could recognize them, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Johnson, for staying on the line and listening to all of our committee.
Again, Madam Chair, I appreciate the extension of courtesy so that I could participate and contribute in advocating for this very important bill. I'm going to ring off at this point. Thank you so much, and I hope you all have a safe trip home.
Best of luck with the work that you're doing in your district today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Next, we're going to have public comment, and that means that anything you'd like to comment on for the Emergency Preparedness Committee or Ocean Policy, please come forward and introduce yourself and do so. If there's anything you'd like for us to take back to Salem, I appreciate all of your testimony, and we will be hearing other issues on ocean policy. Right now, we're trying to get our emergency preparedness work out because we have a package, and I have to tell you that we are woefully unprepared in Oregon at the present time. So let's hope that we don't have a crisis on the coast anytime soon until we can get everything in place and get better organized. So we appreciate your being here today. It was a pleasure for us to be here. We're going to go up to the fourth floor now and help cut a ribbon because you have a wonderful new culinary class that has opened, or school that has opened on the fourth floor in this building. And we're excited for you and happy to join your mayor in being guest and cutting the ribbon there today. So thank you again for that. And if there's no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.